Welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. Today we're talking about episode 9 in our current series, The State versus Greg Lance. That episode is called The Defense Rests. And if you haven't heard it yet, I'd strongly encourage you to go back and listen. There's a lot of juicy stuff in there, and we will be right here waiting for you when you're done. I'm Rebecca Lavoie, host of the True Crime Review podcast, Crime Writers On, and one of the audio editors for Undisclosed. And with me today is Undisclosed host, reporter for this case, and New York Times best-selling author of Adnan's story, and all things great about being her, Rabia Chaudhry. Hi, Rabia.
Rebecca, it's so hard week after week to come up with something. You really can leave that bit.
Well, I can't, especially after seeing all of your Dollywood photos this week on social media. Really, all things you is what I aspire to be. So can't leave
Dollywood
it out.
Dollywood is amazing. Dollywood's amazing.
I'm glad to hear
thank you, Rebecca. Good to be back.
Inspiring people all over America to go check that place out. Mm-hmm. Also with us is an extremely special guest. His name is Bill Rankin. He's legal affairs reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He covers courts in Atlanta, the Federal Appeals Court, and the Georgia Supreme Court. He's worked at the newspaper for 30 years, and his late father previously worked there as well. Bill is also the reporter and narrator of the Breakdown podcast, and I can personally attest, one of the very nicest people, not just in podcasting, but in America. Hello, Bill.
That's very nice. Hello, how are you? Glad to be here.
I just mentioned that you're the host of the podcast Breakdown, one of the first and best podcasts to be made by a newspaper reporting unit. Do you want to just take a chance and like plug what's going on in this new season of Breakdown that you have out right now?
Absolutely. We're in season 7 right now, and it's a interesting, it's a sad case. It's a case of a naked, unarmed man who was having a mental breakdown, charging at a police officer. Anthony Hill was unarmed, and the officer thought he was being attacked, so he shot and killed him. And he is charged with murder, and he's gone to trial. And we're wrapping up season 7 right now. We have about 2 more episodes.
Well, I'm subscribed and I'm downloading. I am waiting so I can binge the whole thing in one day, which is how I like to listen to your podcast because it's so information packed. So I do like to binge it. But I do want to tell people that if there's a podcast that they love and they're waiting or they want to listen to it later, one tip I will give you, because it really does help shows out, especially shows that are reported from newspaper outlets where this kind of reporting is so important to keep doing. Even if you're not listening today, subscribe and download your favorite podcasts like Breakdown. Just do it. It helps us all out. And Bill, I just want to let you know that I am doing that with yours, and I encourage everyone to do the same because your reporting is just so, so great.
Thank you so much. We put a lot into it.
I also want to do a little bit of an update because there is some Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporting and undisclosed crossover happening right now with some news in Georgia. Rabia, can you tell us what's going on with the Joey Watkins case? Of course, that was a season of Undisclosed that focused on his story.
Yep, that was our season 2 a few years back. And, for our listeners who might remember, Susan Simpson, you know, the amazing Susan Simpson in that case, happened to go and track down some of the jurors and found a juror who told her information that technically should get a trial, should get the conviction reversed and get Joey a new trial. And that was that the juror themselves, while they were deliberating, went and took a drive and basically did their own outside research, okay, on the case, which jurors cannot do. And also were, in this case, specifically told, but even if they're not told, they're generally, like, that's not a thing jurors are supposed to do. You're only supposed to consider the evidence that was presented in court. So using that bit of new information, that new evidence, I think in 2016, a new appeal was filed for Joey. This morning, the Georgia Supreme Court had a hearing on that petition, and we watched it. It was live streamed. Colin and I watched it online, as did Bill. Susan is there in person. And it was really interesting to watch oral arguments in the case. What did you think, Bill?
I thought, well, it's very procedural. I guess the key question was, so the key issue is that that juror, it has come out during your podcast that she did this calculation, which she shouldn't have been doing. Mm-hmm. So the lawyer for Joey Watkins filed another habeas petition. And so the question before the court was obviously whether this new evidence should get a new trial for Joey Watkins. So, but it was very procedural in the arguments. One of the main questions was, in a habeas petition, you have to allege a constitutional violation. And some of the judges were skeptical as to whether this new evidence from this juror was a constitutional violation. I got the feeling toward the end of the hearing, though, is that the judge kind of dismissed it, the habeas judge dismissed this out of hand without holding a hearing. I think there's a chance they will send the case back to the judge to have a hearing so this juror can be questioned, and then you can really determine for yourself whether there was a constitutional violation, which was pretty striking. Was right at the end of the hearing, the assistant district attorney who was arguing to uphold the conviction and
this was brutal.
Yeah, he was saying that he was essentially telling the court that if they're going to rule in Watkins' favor, they need to say that every defense lawyer in a habeas petition needs to question every juror in every case, that should be the standard. And the justices did not like that at all. You know, they were saying that's pretty crazy if that's the standard now for every lawyer has to hunt down jurors, you know, get private investigators. And at the end of the argument, Justice David Namias, who's really one of the sharp guys on the court, a former U.S. attorney, he asked the assistant DA, said, before you come to the court, do you moot these cases out in your office? And the guy said, you should have seen the expression on his face. So he just said yes. And that was the end of the hearing. So he was not impressed at all with the prosecutor's argument.
Well, I mean, he looked actually like maybe he had misheard the judge. And I was shocked because that was such a public, I mean, I think a public humiliation. But, you know, it's interesting because, you know, what the justices, the argument they made to the state, and this is absolutely true, they're saying, look, you can have it one of two ways. Either it does not rise to the standard of due diligence for attorneys to have to, you know, it's something that attorneys can do, but they are not mandated to do. Like, it's not something a reasonable defense counsel would do or post-conviction counsel would do, is to go and interview every single juror. And if that's not the case, then this issue is not waived, because what the state's arguing is that, well, he waived this issue. Joey's waived this issue. You can't consider it now because this is something they could have discovered before with due diligence, but they didn't. What the court is saying, well, if this is a matter of due diligence, if you're making the argument that his attorneys failed, then that's an ineffective assistance claim. Joey still has a claim, right? If his lawyers failed to do what was required under the due diligence standard, then he has a different claim. And so, you know, but
I think they're going to say that there was diligence. They were reasonable in how they presented this in the habeas position. And the ultimate question is going to be is whether this is actually a constitutional violation, where Joey's lawyer said, well, it is. The juror actually essentially became a witness against Joey, and it's a violation of the Confrontation Clause. So that was a pretty strong argument too.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, the questioning for Joey's attorney was all about whether or not this was a constitutional violation. And I just thought, well, if you're going to argue that it's not, that means you're giving jurors a pass to conduct all kinds of independent research and then come to their decisions. Because in this
case, ignore judges' orders, right?
Ignore judges' orders. And in this case, the juror actually told Susan that she actually believed Joey was innocent until she did this whole botched up trial herself and then changed her vote to guilty. So it had an absolute impact on the outcome of his case. So there's a prejudice standard right there. Anyhow, let's see what goes. I think it went much better for Joey than it did for the state, but you never know. We never know with judges.
Do you agree with that, Bill?
Oh, yes. I think the best thing you can hope for is for them to send it back for a hearing. I don't know, you know, not all. It was a pretty engaged court today, but it's going to be close. I think it'll be close. Mm. Yeah. But yes, I mean, this case is extraordinary in the fact that they asked the court to review the case and they declined. And then weeks later or a month later or so, they changed their mind.
Yeah, that's
so
strange.
I think that hardly ever happens. So this obviously has the full attention of the court, and that's why they were engaged. So I think they're going to send it back, which is good news for Joey, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Every single day in this country, hundreds of thousands of people have to make decisions about their health. You do it, I do it, our families do it, our loved ones do it. What we're going to do about treating diseases, managing pain, sometimes it can be scary, but it can also be life-changing in a good way. But what happens if you're offered a supposed miracle cure, but you end up worse off than ever? Now, if you listen to Wondery's Dr. Death, you heard about 33 patients in Texas who went in for surgery and had their lives forever changed by an incompetent doctor. Well, host and reporter Laura Belz broke that story wide open, and now she's reporting on another important story, stem cell therapy, and a bad batch that gave a group of patients disastrous results. The new podcast, Bad Batch, will investigate the multi-million dollar under-regulated industry of stem cell therapy, where greed and desperation collide. It's an industry that claims to treat pain, autoimmune diseases, infections, and even autism. This podcast is a cautionary tale, and it's an important listen. It's also, by the way, topping the Apple Podcast charts. So you can subscribe to Bad Batch on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening now. Don't miss it. There's also a link in the episode notes.
I just remember, you know, listening to that case on Undisclosed, and it was bananas, like in so many ways, not for the least of it being just the way that they said the murder happened just made like no sense. I remember that very, very yeah. clearly. And I also remember very clearly at the time that you guys said on your podcast that he had like little to no options left. So it's really incredible yeah. that this thing that you uncovered, that Susan uncovered, is the basis for it's really, you guys aren't taking enough credit out there in the world for this. I'm just going to say that on the record. I would be telling everyone.
Well, you know, every so often we get mentioned in a newspaper as an audio podcast who had something to do with the case. So that's always great. Right.
Well, then today they referred to you as an investigative reporter during the arguments. Awesome. I'm sure you caught that.
I did. I'm like, she's sitting right there in the audience.
I'm always very interested at just in a final point on juror conduct and how it, you know, it is very easy to look at a piece of juror conduct like this later and be like, what? Like the thing that really sticks out to me is in the Pam Smart trial here in New Hampshire. You guys familiar with that case? Pam Smart, yes. So there was an alternate juror in the courtroom who was recording with a tape recorder stuff going on, like in the hotel rooms when she was talking to other jurors.
What?
And like, this is all part of this HBO documentary. It's insane. And it really does point to it, whether or not you sort of land on like innocence or guilt. The trial was so imperfect. It was the first ever televised trial. The television camera super influenced it. But the juror misconduct is really like, you know, policing that afterward, you can see that it presents challenges, but you also, that can't be the burden of both the state and the defense to then interrogate every juror about every minute of every day they spent while being on a sequestered jury. So it really is extraordinary that you guys revealed this issue. And I'm really interested to see how it turns out.
When I'm in a trial, I always think how many of the jurors are doing research on their own, you know, when they get home at night. I mean, it happens all the time, but it rarely comes out like it did in your podcast. It's fantastic.
Totally. And there's also like this whole other aspect. You know, when you go to the pool to potentially get selected for a jury, you can see the names of the cases that are being selected like on the court website. And, you know, so even before you're selected, you have the opportunity to just Google the names and no one has given you instruction at that point. Like I had this experience earlier this year when I was in a jury. Like I saw the names on the court docket, which is on their website. And Kevin, my husband, had to remind me, like, yeah, you can't look those up. Like, you're tainting yourself. And I was like, yeah, but technically no one has told me I can't look them up yet. But he was right. But it doesn't say that anywhere in the instructions when you just show up. Like,
well, look, I think it's an important question during voir dire for attorneys then to very specifically ask potential jurors,
course.
Did you look anything up? So they can eliminate people like you, Rebecca.
Yes, I didn't. I didn't do it. But it did occur to me that I could have. Anyway.
Right.
All right, well, let's get back to this week's episode. I'm just going to give a quick synopsis of what went down on episode 9 of the Greg Lance series. Once again, this week's episode is called The Defense Rests, and in it, is my favorite thing that Undisclosed does, the unraveling of the state's case and all of the evidence the state presented at trial. The episode opens up with Greg's statement before his sentencing, maintaining his innocence, and his testimony at the hearing on a motion for a new trial, in which he recounts his movements in the week of the murders. Greg was one of three witnesses to testify, but his motion was denied and he was sentenced to two concurrent life sentences. The Undisclosed team then examines the three relevant time periods the state argues involve Greg either preparing for the crime, committing the crime, or covering up evidence about the commission of the crime. These three time periods were the day the neighbors heard gunfire and found gas cans at the Heron Farm, which I like to now call the Red Herring Farm. That's my personal take on it.
That's perfect.
The evening of the murders and the day neighbors and others saw someone burning something at the Heron/Red Herring Farm. On each of those periods, what the state alleged to have happened was impossible, given the evidence putting Greg Lance in other locations. In all three time periods, there are witnesses, phone calls, and even security camera footage putting Greg nowhere close to the Heron Farm. The red car that the state tried so hard to tie to Greg likely belonged to a couple that was taking a look at the farm to buy it that weekend. No one ever tracked them down before, even though Greg's family had given this information to his defense team. This episode then looks at the witnesses the state presented that tied Greg to the crime or one of these time periods. The four men who knew him personally, Rocky Harmon, Mike Snow, Keith Herbstreit, Eric Tanner, and three men who saw Greg at the farm, allegedly, Jerry Gardner, Bryant Brinker, and Marlon Ray. Many of these witnesses, in one way or another, expressed that they had been pressured to testify as they did by the state, and some had received some benefit for testifying. While Keith didn't completely recant, he made repeated attempts on video to recreate the burn marks on a cord to see if the cord attached to the murder weapon was indeed his. He failed each time in his recreations and ultimately apologized to Greg for his false testimony. So there's a lot going on.
That was amazing audio from that from that woman who taped, who recorded all that. That was incredible.
Yeah, that footage is really remarkable. It's something to see.
Can you talk about that a little bit, Robbie? Let's just start right there, because Keith, as we mentioned, didn't completely recant. And I think that I'm probably not the only listener of this season to wonder about, you know, Keith potentially being in the frame for this crime. His car was, you know, taken by the cops at one point. And, you know, he is kind of in the middle of the story in myriad ways. So how did she get him to do this recreation? Like, what was the story around him being willing to do that?
Oh, gosh. Well, the story, as I have been told, is not necessarily very favorable to Keith. I will say this, and we're going to have Greg's advocate, Linda, on later on a different addendum. But, you know, his family has been dogged in trying to continue to collect evidence and talk to witnesses and do all this stuff. I mean, all those ropes and all those trials. I mean, like, if you watch the video, they sealed them. They labeled them. It's part of the video. His mother put them in a safe deposit box. I mean, like, they just went to extraordinary lengths to try to get justice for Greg. What happened was Greg's mother tried for years to get Keith to talk to her afterwards, and he wouldn't. He just wouldn't do it. Well, there was a young woman named Jara who worked in Joyce's office, and we hear a little bit about her, and we're going to hear from her later in the season. But she became friends with Greg, and in fact, they became more than friends later on. And Joyce thought, well, Greg's mother thought, well, maybe I'll take Jara and see if Keith will talk to her. Now, Joyce thinks that because Keith is a bit of a ladies' man, and he was just kind of impressed with Jara. She was young and attractive and all those things. And Jara got him not just to talk, but to keep showing up over and over and over to do this test. And I mean, that is her theory, because she said he refused to talk until Jara showed up and talked him into it. So, you know, and he just, you know, he had a lot of, exactly what you said, Rebecca, Keith had a lot of pressures on him, because he absolutely was a suspect along with Greg. He was named as a suspect in many of the early reports. They took his car. They didn't seize Greg's car. They seized Keith's car. And he really kind of stopped being a suspect after he gave his statements to the police.
He sounded so genuine during that experiment. And I hated it, though, when he told the little girl to shut up. I didn't like that. I thought she was
that's
so
genuine.
Cute. Yeah. What did she say? Yeah. Hallelujah. Yeah. That was so sweet.
Yeah. That's Greg's daughter.
Oh, really?
Yeah. you know, it's interesting. People who know Keith, including his wife or ex-wife now Kay, who knew him, you know, generally said that, look, Keith was kind of all about kind of saving himself. And I don't know how much of it was genuine versus how much of it was him really wishing he was right.
Right.
I do think that he actually was convinced by the DA and the TBI agent that that rope was his. And so when he, now he's trying to recreate this, it's not working. He's like, I mean, that's why I think he tried it four times. So yeah, maybe, but I do think he sincerely felt terrible about then having been wrong on the stand about the rope.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess my other question is then, I mean, this is obviously just, I don't expect Bill, a working journalist, to answer this question, but does this, like, his apology to Greg, him being willing to do this experiment, him like trying to prove himself right and then being wrong, does this sort of point away from, you know, any suspicions you might have that he actually might be involved in this crime, Rabia? Because it certainly gave me a different take on him. Before this, he was just sort of an unknown to me. His name was just all over the case in all these different ways. And, you know, every time it was there, it just seemed like I kept thinking like there was going to be an episode that you guys might do that pointed to Keith as like potentially the person who committed this crime. And then I heard this and I feel differently now, you know, despite how I might feel about him personally, him hearing telling little girl to shut up. I do feel differently about his role here. Is that how I'm supposed to feel? What do you think, Rabia?
It's interesting to me because from the day I began looking at this, I personally never looked at Keith as a viable suspect. Because kind of like Greg, there's really nothing tying him to the murders.
Right.
There's no forensic evidence. There's no witnesses. There's nothing. I mean, there's just, he had no motive. Yeah, there's just nothing there. So why would I consider him?
Well, you know why you would? Because he's like, in some ways, he's like the J of this case, right? He's like,
it's a bunch of J's in this case.
Yes. Yeah. But to me, he's the J-iest of all the J's in this case. And it would be easy. It would be easy, and I'm sure that law enforcement to some extent did this if he felt so much pressure. It would be an easy and overly simplistic thing to say either Greg's lying or Keith's lying, right? Just like Sarah Koenig did with Adnan and Jay.
The thing is this, though. I now know that we all know that that is not, I mean, that setup, it doesn't work. That either
exactly.
Jay or, like, it's not, that's just a false pretense.
It's a false premise.
Yes, it's a false premise. And so I feel the same way about Keith. It's not an and or. I mean, like Keith and Greg and all the original statements that were given by, you know, the folks who were right there at the Ford Trailer Park on the day of the murders lined up. And nobody's statement really changed except for Keith's.
One thing I was going to say about this, the rope or the cord, was that when I heard the episode about the trial where the forensic examiner found it to be inconsistent with, you know, what the prosecution was trying to say, right? And that the defense either didn't read the report or didn't ask it, raise questions about it, that was ineffectiveness. But now I'm thinking, well, that maybe that's not even the case now because it's not the court. I don't know. But it seemed a pretty blatant error by his defense attorney not to go further into it, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That was a big thing. I mean, but there were a lot of big things in this case. The way I look at it, for example, is them failing to kind of point out the impossibility of the timeline the state's presenting. You know, you're making these arguments that they didn't connect, and a lot like Gutierrez, in fact. I mean, they didn't connect the dots properly, but certainly they didn't. They could have, this was easily impeachable. They didn't do that. They also didn't impeach other witnesses on the stand. They were juggling a lot of things, and we haven't gotten into actually what we heard about in the trial. The episode about the trial was about the witnesses that the jury heard. There are witnesses the jury didn't hear about, and we are going to get into that, I think, in about 2 weeks.
Who were the other two witnesses who testified at the motion for a new trial?
Yeah, so the reason, one of them actually was, the state called him, was Greg's own defense attorney, defense investigator, Ronald Lax.
What?
And yeah, it was weird.
That's weird.
And it is weird. And what the state wanted him to testify to was that Greg's attorneys did a good job. And, you know, that they were not ineffective. And so, and he kind of sort of did, and that his own investigation was, because, you know, Greg was also saying, my investigator didn't do a good job. I think it's a stretch to say he didn't do a perfect job, but I don't know who can. And, you know, there were things he missed very clearly, but he did do a lot of work in the case from what I can see. And so, you know, but that he was a state's witness. And the third witness, we're actually going to talk about in our second to last episode. So I'm going to hold on to him for now.
All right. Well, so far in this series, a lot of undisclosed listeners, I've seen them on social media, including listeners in my own podcast, have repeatedly come to the same conclusion as the jury, that so many witnesses in this case saying the same or similar thing. It couldn't possibly be a coincidence, even during the three relevant time periods. Robbie, you sent me a note. You said this effect is known as the illusion of truth, the tendency of people to believe false information to be correct after repeated exposure, a phenomenon we are seeing increasingly in politics right now. Robbie, why do you think it is so hard to overcome this illusion of truth effect? Even if there's cold, hard facts, even if you can say, you know, the farm clearly has little or nothing to do with this case or this isn't the car. Why is it so hard to overcome? What's your theory about that?
I'm actually not sure why it's so hard to overcome because maybe I'm being too kind to myself, but I feel like if I'm presented with like facts, like actual, you know, evidence that is, you know, like hard evidence that would overcome what I think people are saying about something, because then I'm going to think those people are either mistaken or lying, right? Or forgetting or something. But in this case, I mean, I'll give an example of this, you know, and I think, Rebecca, even you've said this, and I've seen other people say this online, is that, well, so many people said the same thing about the hitman. So many people, different people said he tried to hire all these hitmen. The truth is only one witness testified to that. But for some reason, the perception is that we kind of clumped them all together. Mike Snow was the only one, the guy who said he gave me $2,500 as a down payment. Nobody else actually said that Greg tried to hire a hitman or offered me money for it. Like nobody else testified to that, but they all kind of raised the same suspicions around him. So we kind of clumped them together.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't really know.
Bill, do you think there's some part of this that's like the pride of like not being wrong? I mean, isn't there some sort of measure of pride that comes into play when it's like, I can't be seen to change my mind, because then I'd have to reconsider everything that I've ever said or thought. I don't know. Sometimes I think it's just that, as simple as that.
Well, I talked to Barry Scheck a couple of years ago about one case I was looking at, and how I was asking him how, when evidence strongly showed that this person, it was Devanya Inman, who was in prison, you know, with life without parole, showed that someone else did it. You know, he started talking to me about all these forced confession cases he had where, you know, it later came out, even through DNA, that the person was innocent. And even then, prosecutors would have another theory guy was with another guy, you know, and raped the woman. And he called it sunk costs, where the prosecutor, you know, they put so much into it already. And I guess they have blinders on, I guess, in some cases, where they won't look at the plain evidence right in front of them. It frustrates the hell out of me. And, but there are exceptions, right? Like just in Philadelphia, what just happened, right? With the DA up there. So, yeah. But it's very frustrating. It drives me crazy.
In poker, it's called being pot committed, when you've already put so much in and you can't fold. You just can't, because you're like, I'm already in this far. I may as well keep. And you actually, your brain changes. It's like this whole like gaming, like psychology thing where your brain actually changes. You start to believe that if you give up, your chances will change. Like if you stay in, your chances will improve. If you give up, your chances change. And it's just not true. It's just not how chance works.
But this is so different. This is about someone's liberty, you know?
Exactly. Exactly.
This is not about, you know, it's just, that's why it just drives me crazy. Anyway.
Well, you know, I mean, I was going to say it's interesting to me that this effect only, whatever you want to call this, only ever benefits the state, ever. There are so many times when, I mean, like even in the case, like for example, Stephen Avery's case, right? The first conviction, the rape conviction, right? Which he was clearly innocent of. He had like, I think a dozen relatives testify to his alibi saying he was with us. I mean, like, you know, I don't know how many hours away from the crime scene. And the jury did not believe that. Yeah, you know what I mean? So for some reason, you know, all those witnesses are giving the same information. It's the same narrative, but they're not trusting that. I really think it goes back to the privilege the state has, and prosecutors and law enforcement, when they get up in front of juries, you know, juries just kind of don't believe that these people, these official people, will lie to them. But I also want to say this. I mean, you know, juries, I mean, it's like any other person, right? Like, we're all susceptible to this. But my issue really here is with prosecutors when it comes to the fact, like, if the DA in this case is looking at this case and he's saying, well, we've got, you know, these statements that the police, that these witnesses gave to law enforcement. But here is all this hard evidence. We know where Greg was at 2:36 p.m. We know that Greg was on this videotape this night. We know that Greg was on this phone call with Mike Heron later in August. How can the DA overlook, right, like, of facts and say, I'm still going to go ahead and prosecute this case?
Well, that's what came out. What was it, a guy named Pokey you interviewed? Who
Pokey,
said,
yeah.
Pokey, is that Lester?
Lester Klaus, right. You do have a great memory with names.
Well, that was striking because, you know, what Pokey said was striking because it sounded like the prosecutor had told Mike Snow that they had that video from the convenience store, right? At what time was that? 12:30?
Yeah, 12:40, yeah.
12:40. And what was the other thing they had that?
He was at the storage unit. Yeah, he was at the storage unit at 5:47 a.m. Yeah.
That was powerful. I mean, that's, so they knew.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, and I don't understand how you would say that what he's saying is not true, because how would he know that otherwise, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing that's crazy to me about the whole storage unit thing is that Greg's version of this is so believable. Like, I have expensive tools, so I leave him at this other place that my, and I don't want to, you know, put words in his mouth, but like, as a juror, I can imagine, like, imagining this, my sort of like ne'er-do-well, you know, day labor colleagues, like, I don't want them to have access to my very expensive stuff. So to keep it safe, I store it in this storage unit, which, by the way, I have had plenty of work done on my house and know lots of carpenters who are friends. That is a very common practice, to have like a safe place to lock up your tools. That's why you see so many contractors driving around with those locked trailers that they can leave at job sites and stuff. Like, those things are secure for a reason, because that stuff is expensive. It's all much more believable than the idea that he's using this storage unit as some sort of criminal staging area, when he clearly has access to all tons of places he could be using as a criminal enterprise staging area.
Like, but the thing is this, like, if you think about, like, I never understood the state's point, because again, the funny thing is, at the trial they kept raising this, but they did not connect it to their theory of the case. Like, what do you think he was doing at the storage unit? Greg did not, you know, did he really have to hide a couple of gas cans? Everybody out there is driving around.
He could just have them in his car. Exactly.
Yeah. Nobody would find that suspicious.
The timing too, though, the timing of when he rented, when he opened that unit, wasn't it very close to?
Yes. Yeah. It was the week of the murders. Yeah.
Right. So it seemed, when I first heard that, I was suspicious about it. It's, you know, all these possibilities are going on in my head. So maybe that's why it was before the jury. They just didn't go into it much, but it was out there, right?
You know, I want to ask you about something else, Bill, because a big part of this narrative, and I think that Greg's team was aware of how problematic this was, and that's why they didn't put, like, one of the reasons why they didn't put, like, Debbie, non-Debbie, on the stand, is that Greg had a, like, let's put it, like, non-traditional relationship with the women in his life. It makes me think a little bit of your season two, the hot car case, with Ross Harris, and how, you know, just being a guy who, like, cheated on his wife, like, completely changed the tenor of not just, like, the legal case around him, but the media case around him, and all of the narrative was completely swayed by that.
And not just cheated on her. I mean, my goodness, the extent to what he did was just breathtaking. I mean, before the trial, I'd talked to defense attorneys who had covered the case, weren't involved, but they said this was the most powerful thing that the prosecution could put before the jury, because they were going to despise him.
Yeah. Right.
You know, nobody could get inside his mind to know exactly what he was thinking when he locked that door and walked away from Cooper. But goodness, nobody liked him at the end of this case.
Yeah. I guess if you're going to plan a murder, it pays to be a good person, and not cheat on your spouse and text a million people about it, you know, while or
Yeah, when he walked away from, I thought about it when he was walking away from his car with his son inside. You know, he was sexting with
Yep.
another woman, and you know,
Oh.
here's Amber Geiger, right?
Yep.
When she walks into that apartment, that's what she's doing at this. You know, it's just, it's not a good look.
Right. It's not. It's not, especially when you're in front of jury of your peers who love being judgy, because that's what we do.
What a decision, though, to make when you have an absolute alibi witness and not to call her, even though she has the time wrong, right? And the time can, I guess, you know, the prosecution could have poked holes in her. Maybe the jury wouldn't have believed her because she didn't have the time right, because they could show that there's conflicting evidence about that. But my goodness, not to call her at trial,
Agreed.
that was a, whew, I guess you would think he's having second thoughts about that now.
What I thought was odd was that it was just a reminder that his attorneys and the investigator, they really wanted to put her on the stand. It was Greg that said no. And Greg's big, it wasn't that he didn't, although I think he was right in the, well, his calculation wasn't so much that they're going to hate me because I had a one night stand and she had a one night stand and that kind of thing. Although I absolutely think that would have been true. We're talking about the Bible Belt here. But Greg's objection was that she had her facts wrong. And so if I was Greg's attorney, I would have gone back to her and said, listen, so that's what you remember. This is what Greg remembers. And by the way, here's some video footage of him that night. Do you think you could be mistaken? Like, you know,
Right.
and you don't just leave that out there. If this is your client's, you know, objection, you can actually, you know, work, like, you know, you can do something about it without actually asking her to change her testimony, without, you know, coercing her, just saying, present her with other evidence to say, maybe you need to jaw, you know, maybe you're not remembering correctly.
Yeah,
Is it
maybe you're remembering a
possible?
different time with a
Yeah,
different
yeah.
person. Or what? No, I completely agree with that, Robbie, and I agree with Bill too, because I think that even if she had gotten up there, and Bill, you might be thinking of this differently than I am, but I just think that even as a juror, even if she had gotten up there and, you know, even if they'd worked with her and they figured out a new thing, and then the state asked her a question that, you know, and then she had somehow ended up revealing that originally she got the time wrong or whatever, even the fact that there's confusion
Yeah.
around where he had been and at what time, like that is doubt, right?
Yeah. And the state would have worked with it. Yeah.
How credible she is means everything, but that's his alibi right there.
I mean, the state would have worked with it, though. The state would have said, oh, wow, Greg is able, and they were saying, you know, Greg is able to slip in and out of rooms with women he's knocked out and still go commit this crime. I mean, you know, it's like you said earlier, if the state oftentimes is challenged with a fact, they will work around that fact and just come up with a different theory.
Right. Well, they're pot committed.
Right, she could say, do you think this is something I want to be doing, being on a witness stand saying that I cheated on a man's wife, you know, I slept with someone, a married man? I mean, she could have come back at him, I guess, but
Right.
you know, I've never talked to her, obviously, but
Yeah.
yeah. And the other thing too is that, you know, Becky married him anyway. So, you
Yeah.
know.
And Becky was in the courtroom. Becky was in the courtroom. So I can imagine also Greg having to think about his wife sitting there hearing this. You know, he
Right.
loved her a lot.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, it is not uncommon for prosecutors to posit whether a defendant who's maintaining their innocence is claiming some kind of big, unlikely conspiracy theory against them, like D.A. Gibson did at Greg's hearing for a new trial. But my question is, when someone is in fact wrongfully convicted, and it has to do with lots of witnesses coming forward and convincing the jury of something, and there does take lots of work on the prosecutor's side to get this conviction to happen, isn't there in fact a big conspiracy that they are claiming? That isn't that true? Whether or not it's intended as a conspiracy, isn't that actually what that person experienced in their own defense?
Yes, absolutely. I guess yes, yes. You know, I thought about that, and you know, there are wrongful convictions that happen, and there's terrible misconduct by prosecutors. I was, you know, obviously most prosecutors and police, most all of them, do the right thing, but there are cases where there's terrible misconduct. And I guess the thing is, when you hear about this, you just don't want to believe it so much because this is our justice system. You want it to be fair. You want everyone treated fairly. You want people to do the right thing. So, you know, when this kind of stuff comes up, my inclination is just to think, how can this possibly happen? You know, but it does. It does.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's sad.
Yeah. I mean, and it's not so, I mean, you know, it doesn't take, I think the when people think about, oh, could it be a big conspiracy? And I've heard people say this about different cases. What you're imagining, what people are imagining is like an entire police department in on it, like whole agencies. And no, it's not. It's literally the same two cops that are going from witness to witness to witness, from case to case to case. And you see a pattern all the time in those cases with those particular cops.
Right. Well, we've talked about this a lot, you know, on my show about, you know, very often it's Toby who will be like, well, is it likely? I'm like, but this is the thing. People imagine a conspiracy being like a shadowy television show scene where people get together in a room and decide to screw somebody intentionally. Yeah. And that is not how it works. How it works is this is the way that they do their jobs routinely. And the act of doing their jobs routinely this way is a conspiracy, you know, it turns into a conspiracy because they're wrong. And so they're filling in gaps or whatever. But it's not like the mwahaha mustache twirling conspiracy that people associate with that word. It's just this is how they do their jobs and it's wrong. And they've done this to lots of other people, likely. And this is just the way they go about this work. Right.
Yeah. And let me just say, you know, in this case, and I have seen this in, I saw this also in the Chester Holman case, where all the witnesses who serve the state, every one of their statements, handwritten statements, is actually in the same handwriting. And then it's just signed
goodness.
By the witness.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah. Every one of these. Brian Brinker, Marlon Ray, Keith, all of these statements are written in the
who wrote
same
them?
Exact probably Krofcik. And the funny thing is, Jerry Gardner, Brinker, and Marlon Ray, the three people who, you know, were coerced into saying they saw Greg at the farm, also with their statements provided handmade maps of the farm to show where they were and where Greg was. And in their statements, they actually wrote, well, Krofcik wrote that, you know, I made the map by myself. The map, all three maps are exactly the same, made by the same person. Like, they're literally... You can tell it's the same handwriting on the maps. It's unbelievable. And it's so blatant. And it's just enraging. That's a conspiracy. That's a conspiracy to get somebody.
Yeah. Bill, have you ever seen anything like that before? Where,
no.
You know, yeah, me neither. It's amazing to me that that could be a thing. It really is. You know, imagine the way that I can't help but think that imagine a way that a cop could use that technique of them writing the statement out and being like, just sign it with people who, like, I don't know, can't read super well or who just want to get out of there really bad. There's a million ways that can be used. That technique. It's terrible. I remember hearing about that in the Chester Holman case and almost falling off my chair.
When I first started covering courts in a suburban county outside of Atlanta, it was a long time ago, it was typically the case for when the lead investigator took the stand, they would introduce the statement that had been given by the defendant, and it was always written by the investigator and, you know, and signed by the defendant. You know, I don't know how after how many hours, too, you know, or what had gone on before that, but I was just thinking, why don't we just have a recording of what he said?
Right.
But now I think they do that. I know. I think they do that more often here now. But
right.
It was, it just makes you wonder.
Yeah. Rabia, I just want to tell you, I loved hearing your reaction talking to the woman who was the potential real estate buyer at the Red Herring Farm about her red car. Was this really the first time anyone had ever talked to them about what
kind
of...
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Talk about that, please.
Yeah. So, you know, the funny... Oh, this is... I feel terrible saying this. But the truth is, you know, Greg's mother was the one who was able to... Because she had the contact with the real estate agent. And I actually found her hand... I found her note to the investigator from 20 years ago where she said, these people might have been at the farm. Just check it out. And when she was able to get their contact information, she said, this is the contact information if you want to talk to these people. And I actually, in my head, thought... Originally, I thought... I don't really need to talk to them because I know that Greg couldn't have been there. He was at National Guard duty or he, you know what I mean? I was like, there's, what's the point? And I thought, okay, fine. You know, you never know. I'll just give him a call just to see. And so nobody had actually spoken to her before about this at all. And nobody had asked, obviously nobody had asked that question either. And I remember just thinking, like, maybe I'll get lucky with this answer. And I couldn't believe it when she said to me that it was a two-door red Toyota and that her husband
also had a two-door red car.
Yeah, another Japanese car. And I can't remember because there's so many different reports. One of the reports does say that the car that was seen was just Japanese or a small squat Japanese car.
Yeah. And she said bright red. She said bright red, which was like, oh, man. Bill, what are your thoughts when you heard that piece of tape? I'd like to revel in this like with you a little bit, because to me, this is what Undisclosed does, that, you know, there's no one else doing this kind of work in podcasting. You know, these are like lawyers, not journalists, tracking down sources, getting them to talk about things that have never been discussed before, not dissimilar to this Joey Watkins case. It's like a real mic drop moment in podcasting, right?
Well, that's what I like to call it. Podcast gold.
Yeah.
I use that term when you come across something like that. It doesn't happen very often, but my goodness, when it happens, it makes what you're doing all the worthwhile, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, and believe me, I was like, oh my God, I hope my recorder worked. was my recorder working or not?
It was barely working. As the person who had to edit that audio, did require some juicing, but it was worth it. It was worth all of the work it required. It was amazing. Now, let's get back to that Keith reconstruction for a minute. He did try to reconstruct the fireworks burning the cord. Eventually, we heard him apologize to Greg, as we mentioned, but he didn't apologize about any of his other testimony. Was he asked about that?
Yeah, so, you know, I asked Joyce and Jer about that, about, you know, what about the other stuff that he said? Because, I mean, like, the other things that he said were incriminating were... He testified about like this conversation he had with Greg, where Greg was like a couple, I don't know, days or weeks before the murder. Greg's like, yep, I guess I'm gonna have to kill him. And that was pretty much it. And then Greg acting weird afterwards. And that was it. But they didn't ask about anything else, because they said that what they remembered from the trial was that this was the big piece of evidence, right? The prosecutor said that this was the evidence that tied Greg to the murder. And in their minds, they thought, if we can disprove this, kind of nothing else matters. And so that's the only thing they were thinking about. I think to them, the other stuff was just kind of BS, the way some of the other witnesses just BS'd. But this was actual hard evidence, and so they wanted to focus on that. Mm. And that's what they did. So actually, they hadn't, actually never asked him about it.
Robbie, a listener named Erica wants to know, what was the significance of the part about Greg not having the same shirt on, the polo versus button-up debate? She thinks she missed something. Do you want to just explain that real quick?
Yeah, I mean, this is what you call a stupid detail that the state probably made Eric Tanner testify to for no reason. You know, they realized that in order for Greg to have been here and then here and then here, like, he had to have kind of been up all night. And then, you know, the investigators showed up at his house the very next morning, basically. So they had Eric testify that, yeah, Greg didn't even change his clothes. He was in the same clothes this whole time. Like, because he was out murdering people all night, it's so stupid on so many levels, because if you did go out and murder people and set a house on fire, the first thing you might want to do is get rid of the clothes you're wearing.
Right.
And so, I mean, like, none of it made sense. But I also wanted to just point out that it actually, I mean, Greg, there's notes in his file where he has asked investigators over the years to, can you get a better mugshot to prove I wasn't wearing? It was just a point of contention for him, because he's like, I know I wasn't wearing the same clothes.
Right.
But the truth is, if he had murdered those people, he probably would not have been wearing the same clothes anyway. So it was just another stupid detail that to me shows that, you know, the witnesses were just ending up saying stuff that the state wanted. I mean, that's what it says to me, at least. It was just a dumb detail.
Yeah, not for nothing. But he also would have been wearing the same clothes that he wore when he went and slept with another woman, which everyone knows you do not do if you are sneaking around behind your, you know, girlfriend's back. You change. That's what you do. I think there's a really good question on Twitter here that I also had, but have never thought to ask, about the burn marks on the rope attached to the gun. Why does no one presume that those burn marks are because of the fire on the night of the murders? That seems to make more sense than fireworks in a tree. Now, those firework tree thing, that was just an attempt to tie the rope to Greg, which apparently was more important to investigators than tying the rope to the actual scene of the crime where there had been a fire. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right, number one. But I also think because the way if you, and we do have some pictures on our website, but the rope, it wasn't burned in the way you would think any item would be burned if it was just exposed to fire. It had burn marks like every, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 inches, like in very regular intervals, which suggests something else. And I don't know what. I don't know if to me, it seems like maybe the cord would have been rolled or wrapped up at some point, and then one part of it got burned. So that when you opened it up, it had little burn marks every couple of inches.
Yeah, but, that's what I assumed.
Yeah, so maybe that's what it was. But certainly tying they had to find a way to connect this weapon to Greg. They just had nothing. So
How long was the cord?
Oh, I have not seen any official measurements. Just from looking at it, I would say maybe about 2 feet long.
Right. So if somebody has this cord attached to the gun for whatever reason, I know that Susan knows what the reason is, but I just forget.
A sling? A sling.
Right. So they're either going to have 2 feet of rope hanging from a gun, or they're going to wrap it up and hold it in their hand or whatever, right? So it makes sense that it would not be in its full length exposed to fire. I don't know. That's just what I assumed.
Yep. We also don't know for sure if it was burned. I mean, yeah, we keep saying it, but literally the lab never actually says that these were burn marks. We could be dirt for all we want to know. We just don't know. That's what they're calling it.
Right, right. I do want to give a plug for your website, by the way, because I do sometimes forget to go there, even though I hear in the podcast every week that I should. And when I do go there, like I did today before we recorded this, like you guys have made it very easy to navigate, like the documents, the photos and everything. So if listeners really are curious about seeing this stuff, check out the website. It's undisclosed-podcast.com. And like all the case files are there that the team has compiled. Transcript for every episode and every season they've ever done. It's fascinating to look through it all. So that's a plug for me. Another question from Anne, and then Bill, I'm going to give you a chance to ask any questions you might have. But Anne asked a good question. I would love for you to clarify, Rabia. She's curious about the whole time difference thing you talked about in the episode, you know, how Greg is supposed to be in two places at once, but would have also gone back in time because of that time difference with California. Can you just briefly explain that for Anne and for others who may have been confused?
Yeah. So what the state said was that Mike Heron got the heads up that the police were going to be investigating his farm. He had no idea that Greg was connected to anything. But when he called Greg, that alerted Greg. And so Greg went out to the farm. The problem is that the call that Mike Heron made was made from Arizona at 4:23 p.m., I think it was, Arizona time. This was during daylight savings time, and the local time in Cookeville was 6:23 p.m. Well, all of the stuff that was happening at the Heron farm that day, the burning, the whatever, the blue and white truck that, you know, the Powells saw, that happened around 4 o'clock or earlier. So if Greg was alerted at 6:23 p.m., that, oh no, the police are going to find your evidence at this farm, and he went out there, well, it doesn't make sense. I mean, either right, he was out there burning all the stuff earlier, but Mike, he didn't even know any of that was happening. He had no idea the police were going out to the farm until Mike Heron told him.
And has this something that nobody else has figured out before you guys in this podcast, that this time differential never brought, it was brought up?
It was kind of brought up at the trial, but the attorneys just, again, it's like they brought it up and they failed to nail it. It's so weird because you actually, there's pages and pages of transcript, and with the judge and the attorneys can't figure out what the local time was when it was 4:23 p.m. in Arizona. They had to pull out like a map of time zones, and it was just weird.
Well, to be fair, is part of Arizona not part of daylight saving or something like that?
That is right.
Yeah,
Arizona does not do daylight savings time.
Right,
but the point is this. Either there's a 1 hour difference or there's a 2 hour difference. It's one or the other, right? Either way.
Either way, it doesn't work.
It's not rocket science.
It reminds me, recently I missed a deadline because of the way they write dates in Europe. I thought I had like 6 more months.
Oh, no.
So just so you know, stuff like this does happen. But again, as Bill pointed out, no one's life was on the line with my stupid deadline.
Oh, God. Well, everybody argued about it in court, and then basically that point went nowhere. It just completely got lost in the muck. It was terrible.
Well, Bill Rankin, before we wrap up, do you have any questions for Rabia about the case or what you've heard so far in this season of Undisclosed?
Well, after listening to the Joey Watkins case this morning, it reminded me of, you know, y'all going out there and tracking down jurors. Are we going to hear from any?
I am hoping so, but we do have, like I said, I mean, his family did a lot of work in the last 20 years, and they also have spoken to some jurors, and this was a long time ago, and unfortunately, a lot of people in this case have died in the last 20 years, including very young people like Mike Snow and Keith and others, so I'm hoping, but so far, no luck.
And is it true they didn't get to take notes? Is that right?
They did not, no.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Is that something that jurors can do in the courts you cover, Bill?
Everyone. I don't think, maybe a long time ago when I first started covering trials, like this one, I guess, when it was going on, the judges would say, we don't want your attention distracted, focusing more on your notes than on the testimony in front of you. But as a newspaper reporter, if I was on a jury, the thought of not being able to take notes would drive me crazy.
Yeah, I wasn't allowed to take notes. That's not something they do here in New Hampshire. You're not allowed to take them here for sure. It made me crazy too. It also made me realize, as I told the panel last week, how easy it would be for one juror who thought they had a strong memory to go in and say, no, here's what definitely was said, and other jurors to be swayed, because I could be convinced because I don't have a perfect, recall. But,
in jurisdictions where jurors cannot take notes, it's all more important for attorneys than to have great, visual stuff, like charts and big pictures and things like that.
Clear stories.
Yeah. Right? Having timelines, having charts is so important. It just makes such a big difference for the jury if they can visualize it.
We covered the Tex McIver trial. That was a couple of seasons ago. The trial judge let the jury ask questions of every witness. He would allow them to write questions down, then he'd screen them, and then he'd let the lawyers. It slowed the trial down quite a bit, but it was fascinating to hear what questions the jurors had. And also, he said he did it, getting back to the point we were talking about initially, he hopes that it would keep them from doing outside research, because they're getting their questions answered, as the trial goes on. So he's one of only a few judges in Georgia that allow it. I really went off topic, but...
No, but I'm trying to think, that could go either way. I'm just thinking, that could be really, it could totally derail the trial.
I think at the end of this month-long trial, there were 300 questions that were asked.
Wow.
But I also think that's great. I think it's great for them to be that engaged.
Well, also, it's the people who need to know getting to ask. It's like they're the ones making the decision, so it kind of makes sense if they didn't understand something or want clarity on something. But, that's what we get to do as reporters, so, All right. Well, Rabia, what's coming up next week on the podcast? I can't wait to hear the next episode. Is there going to be more unraveling?
Well, yeah, in a way, I think so. I think we're going to start looking, taking a little bit step back and looking at Putnam County and looking at, the why behind the why. Okay, now we know why some of these witnesses testified a certain way. Well, who are these people who got them to do that? And we're also going to be starting to look at some alternate suspects who, the same investigators decided were not worthy of looking at.
Listening to the previous episodes, I was really skeptical when y'all kept saying he didn't do it. But I kind of knew that this episode had to be coming, and you didn't disappoint. It was really good.
Great. Thank you so much.
It was. We got to, get these guys
into a
class.
Let me ask you this.
Yes.
Let me ask you this. Are you satisfied with because I know that was a big question for you. How come all these guys are the same thing? Do you feel satisfied from what you heard?
I do. I would tell you as a writer that maybe I would have dropped some of this stuff in before episode 9, because I had eight episodes to sort of gather my doubts. And that's a lot. Eight is a lot to kind of get through while I'm still sort of thinking God, why do they think this guy didn't do it? Of course, I know you, which helps. I know that you wouldn't comfortably say, we've decided this guy was wrongfully convicted if you weren't comfortable with that. So, that's the trust you've built with your audience and with me personally. But I could imagine if, someone didn't feel that trust yet, I am, by the way, I'm telling everyone, and I'm going to say it on my podcast this week, that this, if they have not been listening to this season, I think it's fair to say you could start with this one if you wanted to, because you do a job sort of laying out why everybody would think he was guilty at the start of this episode. So this would be a good one. This is classic Undisclosed. I felt the mic drops coming left and right. I was very excited to listen to it. So I'm changing my mind on my doubts here, Rabia. So you're doing
well. Here's the thing, though. I will say this. the fact that you very early on thought the Heron Farm was a red herring farm actually yeah. shows that there was something in these 8 episodes that made you think oh, yeah. something is wrong
totally.
Here.
the farm thing is BS. Yeah, it has yeah, nothing yeah. to do with the crime. It's so obvious. I don't understand like how they yeah. even able to pass yeah. that. Like this yeah. is a person with access yeah. to an entire world of construction sites and woods and like all sorts. Yeah. He doesn't need to like have a staging yeah. area at his friend's house with neighbors. It's absurd. It's not even connected in any way. Anyway, I stand by that forever and ever and ever. All right. Well, Rabia, can't wait to listen to next week's episode. Thank you so much for talking with us about this week's episode.
Thank you.
And Bill Rankin, what are you working on past this season of Breakdown that we can look forward to reading or listening to from you?
I'm so focused on this season of Breakdown, I'm not thinking of anything else. We are racing to finish, and I think we have a very good, very interesting emotional. It's emotion, a lot of emotion. It's pretty compelling, and I just want to finish it.
It's a heartbreaking story. Yeah.
Bill, where can people find your podcast besides on the podcast apps? Is there a website for it?
Yes. AJC Breakdown.
Great. Everyone needs to check it out. Bill Rankin is great at what he does. He's one of my favorites.
Thanks, Rebecca. That means a lot.
Thanks so much for listening to the Undisclosed Addendum and the Greg Lantz series. You can follow the show on social media at Undisclosed Pod, and you can ask questions for future Addendum episodes on Twitter or Facebook. Just please use the hashtag UDAddendum. Remember, the sponsors of Undisclosed make it possible for the team to continue doing their work, so please support all the sponsors you hear about on this show and buy their stuff. Our executive producer is the great Methil Telhan. Audio production for the Addendum is done by the wonderful and talented Hannah McCarthy. Our theme song was by Patrick Cortez. If you want to hear more of me, check out my true crime and pop culture podcast, Crime Writers On, or listen to These Are Their Stories, the Law and Order and SVU podcast. Thanks to my partner in life and crime, Kevin Flynn, who does do an amazing impression of Bill Rankin. He also picks up a lot of my work so I can host this series. So thanks for that, Kevin. Also thanks to Rabia, Susan, and Colin, who continue to make Undisclosed a great place and a great part of my podcasting gig life. On behalf of everyone on the Undisclosed team, thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week. And he's back fantastic. Doing his Bill Rankin impressions full
That's
time.
Great. I'm so glad to hear that. I was really, you know, the podcast world needs his laugh.
It does. It does. It also needs That's his impressions laughable. Of Bill Rankin. Just saying. Do you know what a podcast is?
I didn't go there this time. I was tempted.